It's cozy season, and nothing compares to wrapping yourself in a Minky Couture blanket. Luxuriously soft, perfectly warm, thoughtfully made. From movie nights to chilly mornings, Minky Couture turns everyday moments into pure comfort. Once you feel it, you'll understand why it's called the original best blanket ever. Visit MinkyCouture.com or a store near you and make this cozy season your softest one yet.
It's a strange shift, isn't it? The parent who raised you needs some help, and you want to be there. With Care.com, you don't have to do it alone. Whether you're clear on the kind of care your aging loved one needs or still figuring it out, we've got support. Find background-checked in-home senior caregivers for anything from companionship to dementia care. Or browse senior living communities, read reviews, even schedule a tour. Plus, access to safety checks to help with your peace of mind. Still not sure what's best? Our senior care advisors, who are all master's-level social workers, can help you build a plan. For a limited time, use the code PODCAST20 for 20% off your initial Care.com subscription. That's PODCAST20, all one word, good for 20% off. Start your senior care journey with confidence.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to Comic Book Club. I'm Alex.
I'm Justin.
I'm Pete.
And we got a special episode for you today with a very special guest. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Tom King. Tom, welcome to the podcast.
Yeah! Woo-hoo.
Hey!
What an absolute pleasure here. What an honor. Thank you for having me on. This is quite a joy. You guys do wonderful work for comics, and I really appreciate it.
Oh man, thank you, honor's ours.
Please, thank you for all your amazing work.
Yes, and one piece of that amazing work that's coming up, and ostensibly the reason that we're talking right now, is Wonder Woman number 31 is coming from DC Comics on March 18th, and it's going to kick off the Wonder War storyline. Now, before we even get to the contents of the book, I'm curious about, like...
I literally had no idea what you were going to say after which thing of content we were going to talk about today.
Well, that's the thing, is you're a busy guy. You got a lot of stuff going on.
Alex, like, say something weirder. Let's see
what I signed on to promote. Like the 10th anniversary of Elmer Fudd meets Batman.
I mean, sure. I don't know. I'd be happy to talk about that. That's fine. I mean, here's my main question, and this is probably the most boring question to everybody else, but this is very interesting to me, is Wonder War is a big event that you've been
building up. How did I come up
to
with that incredible title? With,
yeah, yeah, really. Like, where did the two W's come from? Yeah, I can't figure it out. Yeah. It's a big event, but it's just happening in Wonder Woman, or at least as far as we know, it's just happening in Wonder Woman. Why structure it in this way? Like, why build it as this is the thing we're building to? You know, I guess externally, like, every publisher now is like, we got to do the spinoffs, we got to do the miniseries, we got to blow this out in some way, have the Alpha and the Omega issue. But this seems very focused. So talk to me about the thought process there.
Oh, you start off the bat by asking a question I have no idea what the answer for is. That's good. That's a good place to be when you throw me off. The reason it's happening now, it just seemed to be the next story. I feel it's like my third arc, which is odd because the first arc just lasted for so many goddamn issues, with sort of Sovereign as the big bad guy. And then we had Mouse Man as the big bad guy. And this is our matriarch as the big bad. So it just feels like the start of the next arc. And because Matriarch is a big bad guy in the future, it takes place in the future. And because I like to rip off Chris Claremont because I was his assistant 20 years ago, it's very much a story about a horrible future where everything has gone wrong and people have to change it, which, you know, might be familiar to some particular Chris Claremont story. I was just following the sort of natural progression of where this story was headed and where it was going. And we've always sort of prepped for the coming of the matriarch. And from the very beginning, the Wonder War is just a brilliant title, and I wanted to put it with a brilliant arc. It's those configurations of ideas coming together.
It feels like you've been leading with the villains for your run, specifically on Wonder Woman. Is that an intentional thing, or do you have pictures of them on your wall? Like, how did that come together?
I from the very beginning, I thought of Wonder Woman as just trying to distinguish her from Superman and Batman, who I've written extensively, especially Batman, but I've done some Superman. It was hard in the beginning to think what makes Wonder Woman different than, you know, those two characters, because, you know, she's honest and trustworthy and does the right thing like Superman, but she's kind of badass and a warrior and cool like Batman. What makes her different? What makes her cool? And so my answer was she's a rebel, because on some levels, Superman is a conformist. He's a Boy Scout. He's the guy who kind of, you know, does the right thing, does what everyone expects of him, but in a nice manner. And Batman, for all his rebellious nature, is like the world's best cop. And cops are not rebels. They enforce sort of a law. But Wonder Woman seems to be against a system, as opposed to those two figures who are sort of enforcing a system. And so when I create her as an oppositional figure in that way, as someone who sort of looks at the world and says, how can I make it better, or what can I, you know, overthrow? It naturally sort of said, okay, well, then I need her to be in rebellion against something. And, you know, I keep coming back to sort of Wonder Woman, you know, being a symbol of freedom and being against these sort of different types of fascism and oppression, these different types of sort of ways that people try to control other people. Where she, you know, fights obviously for people just to be themselves. And so I have sort of structured these three villains as three different aspects of that fascist kind of nature. And that's so this is our third fascist detective. We'll see if there's a fourth in the way, if I can throw
it. Is that reflecting anything in the outside world?
That's completely neutral opinion. Mm. No, I mean I think that goes back to her. I mean, yes, of course. There's always sort of a rising tide of evil that we're trying to fight against in the world. But I mean, it goes back to her origin. Wonder Woman was sort of founded as in opposition to, you know, to fascist ideals. That's where she comes from. And, you know, in opposition to, in her case, you know, Nazi Germany, going back to the 40s in her creation. And so I always look to the origin of characters to find out what's special about them. And that was part of her origin story, the idea that it was a different way. She was born into a world that was on the brink of war and starting to be in the war. And Marston said, there is a different way. There is a different path. I mean, for him, it was kind of a bizarre kind of his version of feminism and bondage mixed together path. But he was literally trying to say there is another way, and there is a way to peace that isn't this thing that we are all experiencing. So I'm kind of just taking her origin story and projecting it forward into our times.
Not to speak for you, Justin, but to bounce off of what you were saying, I think you were getting at that the narration that you use, and you always play around with narration in all of your books, but the narration uses the Sovereign for most of the first arc telling the story of Wonder Woman. So it's from his perspective, and that's something that potentially continues as we go forward. Why have it that way? Like, why have it through that particular lens?
I mean, I was looking for a different way to do comics, just something exciting. And I had done, in my Batman run, I had decided no narration. I said Batman become no over narrated. Every Batman story started with, I'm on the prowl and I look out into the dark streets of the night and that stuff.
It looks back at me.
Yes. All that wonderful stuff, which all feels like all like Frank Miller perfected it. And then we're all just kind of like trying to get back at what Frank Miller did. And we can't get there because there's no one who's Frank. So in Batman, I did no narration. In you know, Supergirl, Woman of Tomorrow, I did a third person narration, or you know, where you take a small character and they're narrating the whole thing. And I've done all sorts of weird things. So I was just trying to find a new way into a story that would be awesome. It's like, what if the villain told the story? And I like that, especially because I knew I was creating a villain who was nasty. This is a nasty ass villain in The Sovereign. And I wanted him to say, I just wanted the first line of the whole thing to be like, this is how she defeated me. Just so my audience knew at the beginning, he was going to go down for all the things he would say. And again, it was to set up that thing that I really want from the audience, which is to just like to hate the villain, to despise them, and to feel triumph when Wonder Woman defeats them. Because spoiler alert, Wonder Woman is going to win at the end of the day.
No need to pick up the comic, I guess.
I know, yes.
How's the nature?
Who knows? There might be some twists. Who knows? There's definitely some big things coming.
Well, it's interesting to hear you say that you have a different way of doing comics, because and Alex talking about this being a big event but it's in just one title. I feel like you've been able to meticulously plot out the amount of action and character that you would have across a large event, across multiple titles, and sort of just really lay it out on a long timeline to bring it together for this final arc in the Wonder War.
Yeah, I mean, I've always been bad at events, guys. I did one event, and it's the thing that people most hate me for, called Heroes in Crisis, which... I'm one of the things I don't have a skill for is I don't have a skill to tell other people what to write. I admire this greatly about Scott Snyder, a colleague of mine. Like he's incredible at setting up these things and saying, okay, here's a piece. You take this piece, you do this. And I just like, I'm so bad at like turning to all my friends and being like, write this, write that. I can't, I just, and I'm very bad at when someone says it back to me. So I think I just create events for myself and lead up to big things like that. I did the same thing when I was on Batman as a continuing series. So it comes from my own weaknesses as a writer, not my strengths.
This is very much jumping cross media, and I do want to get back to Wonder Woman, but I am curious because you're working on a showrunner team for Lanterns. It's you, Chris Mundy, and Damon Lindelof, right?
We created the show together, but Chris is the showrunner.
Okay.
Chris Mundy.
But in that case, like, you're sharing the duties, so how does that work? Is that you kind of ceding to Chris in that case?
Yeah, I mean, Chris, you have the PR people, we created the show together, the three of us, right before the writer's strike, and then the writer's strike hit, and then we took a long break, and then came back together and created it one more time. and then got into the writer's room, and basically what it was, Damon didn't want to run the show and neither did I. And so it was, Chris was kind of the last guy standing. Chris was like, I'll take the ball and I'll run with it. But yeah, the idea always was at the end of the day, and Damon and I were very, consistent about this. It was Chris's show. We were pitching and catching and he was calling strikes. So he had final decision on everything because in the end, you know, Damon and I are EPs and we watch the cuts, but in the end we walk away and he stays with the show. It's his 24-hour job. Mm-hmm. So in that way it was always like, sure, we're all in on this, but one of us is in on it more. One of us is dedicating his entire self to this show, whereas we are just here to help him achieve his vision. So Lanterns is definitely Chris Mundy's show, and then we sort of helped him get there. Probably.
How do you feel that these different sides of you feed the other? I mean, imagine like any skill is going to help you with any other skill, but certainly we know you as a comic book writer first. Now you're writing the Archie movie, you're working on TV shows, you're show running Mr. Miracle as well. So how does this all work together? Like, where do you separate the different parts of your brain, or how do you figure it out?
Dude, don't ask me, man. It's been one of those freaking days. Yeah. Literally, like, I started off the day doing heavy Mr. Miracle, and then I'm getting emails on this, Jim Lee Spider-Man Superman project I'm putting together that comes out very soon. And then I was getting emails about writing Wonder Woman, and then emails about writing Archie. So today was like one of the days, like, whoa, Tom, this is just washing over. But all of it is... I mean, all of it goes back to comics. All of it goes back to doing my 10,000 hours. Comics are an incredibly unique place to sort of grow up as a writer. I mean, I started as a novelist, but I feel like I was there a short enough time that I don't consider it a place I was from. I feel like I'm from comics. And in comics, you know, people who do movies and TV, bless them, they're doing, you know, one or two or, you know, max four stories a year, maybe. In comics, we're doing 45 stories a year. You know, I was just at a retreat with a bunch of comic book creators, and we discussed, like, it's such a different mindset to be like, every Monday of our lives, we have to come up with a beginning, middle, and end to a story. And by the end of the week, we have to execute that story, and 3 months later, 100,000 people are going to look at it. That's so different than someone who's writing a movie that's going to come out 3 years from now, and then we'll start a movie another 3 years. Like, that's just it's a different mindset, but it puts you in the mindset you're constantly having to. Jason Aaron, who I admire greatly, a friend of mine, once wrote an article about this, about being a comic writer means you never let story go. That means when you're driving your kids to school, there's story in the back of your head. When you're falling asleep, there's story in the back of your head. When you're taking a shower, there's story in your back of your head. Comics is for writers, it's a 24-hour job just in trying to become creative and creating stories. And that constantly serves all of these things where I've learned to think fast about story because you have to in comics.
Can I?
It's like the constant fire hose is spraying at you in comics. So wow. Now you can do all of these TV and film projects at the same time.
It is. Yes, it is. I do sometimes people in TV film are like, how are you working on all those things? Like, how are you working on just one thing?
Grow up, you say back.
I Tim Seeley, another great friend of mine when I was in the very beginning of my career, who was kind of, he's my age. I feel like stupid calling him a mentor. And also he's Tim Seeley, and I don't want him to get a big head, but he was so utterly kind and mentor-ish to me as a young writer. And I remember, like, when I first worked on Grayson, he said, I was like, how do you succeed in this industry? He's like, you need 4 books. You need to be writing 4 books every month, a book a week. He's like, that's how you make a living. That's how you make a career. And I've stuck to that advice ever since. And so it always feels normal to be working on 4 projects at once, at least.
Is that what you're doing right now? Because obviously we know about Wonder Woman. You mentioned the Spider-Man, Superman series. Do you have other comics that are bubbling in the background? Or at this point, is so much time taken up with the media stuff that you can't do that?
No, I mean, and right now I'm almost transitioning careers, almost like it's 2000. When's the last time I transitioned careers? Like 2013, 12. It used to be I did 90% comics, 10% Hollywood. You didn't hear about the 10% Hollywood because I was hitting all the walls that everyone hits. I wrote the Mr. Miracle screenplay that went nowhere. Or no, sorry, the New God screenplay that went nowhere. I worked on a TV show with Tommy Lee Jones for 2 years of my life that ended up going nowhere. I wrote a Bugs Bunny movie. I'm just crashing into walls. And that was 10% of my time. Now that's flipped. Now I'm doing 90% Hollywood, about 10% comics. So it's a way different lifestyle over the last like 6 months. This is kind of a new leap into a new unknown.
Let me ask you about the Spider-Man, Superman thing a little bit, because we had a page that came out the other day. It was a double page splash of Gambit, Jim Lee drawing Gambit on a car, which was so thrilling. Did you write that? Did you team up with Jim Lee? Just you're like, I got to have you draw X-Men again. I got to have
you. Dude, 100%.
What a great trick you pulled. We all get to enjoy that prank.
Guys, it was, they're like, they called me like, you can do Spider-Man, Superman. I was like, that's one with Jim Lee. I was like, that's wonderful. He's like, the one catch is you can't do Spider-Man and Superman because that's the main book that Mark's doing. So do you want to do, Green Goblin meets Venom? I was like, who wants to watch Jim Lee draw Green? Or do you want to do all these sorts of different combinations of obscure Spider-Man villains? And I was like, no, I don't want to do it. I want to see Jim Lee draw Superman and Spider-Man. That's what I want to do. Like, he's Jim Lee. And then I kind of just want to see him draw the X-Men. And they're like, well, the X-Men actually aren't either a Spider-Man or a Superman villain. And I was like, yes, until now.
Oh, my God.
So I picked Mary Jane and Lois Lane because I knew I could do a lot of Spider-Man, Superman splashes for Jim to draw. Cause I think that's, I wanted to see Jim. Like, sometimes you write to write. I write to make people cry. I write to see my own freaking words. When I have Jim Lee for 8 pages and he's returning to Marvel, where I first found Jim Lee, you know, back in like the Alpha Flight days, and fell utterly in love with Jim's art. And I bought, 5 copies of X-Men #1, 4 to collect, 1 to read. You know, like I had to make this about Jim's art. It wasn't about me. So I used Mary Jane so I could do a lot of like splashes of Spider-Man, Superman, and then obviously Jim created Gambit back in the day, and so I very much wanted to find a way for Jim to return to a character that he created 30 years ago that he hasn't been able to return to since, and give him a huge Gambit, to me, there was something just magical in being like, you created this global phenomenon of a character, and I want to see you stretch your stuff on it all these years later. So, yes, yeah, so I found a way to get Gambit into this story.
What did he say when he read Gambit in there?
I never, it's funny. I was just talking to him last week, and I you want your hero to be like, Tom, this was the story that touched me the most.
Yeah.
You wrote the one. Do you want to do Hush 3 with me? Like, you want to know what you're doing?
Yeah.
You're looking for that validation. But mostly he was like, Tom, do you want to talk about, you know, blood pressure drugs or whatever? like normal, like, dude, like old dude stuff that old dudes talk about. Like, he was very nice. He wrote me a whole note how this was like a ton of fun, which is the absolute best thing. Yeah, I was trying to make Jim Lee have fun. That was the whole point of the story. I was depressed because when I wrote it, I was like, should I? Because I can write 8-pagers that can make you cry. That's like, I have that skill. I can write little dark.
Yeah, you do.
Dark little stories about death and God and all that shit. So I was worried about writing a story that was just about Jim Lee drawing. And so, but I think it came out all right. Yeah.
Well, what about with Wonder Woman? Because you've been working with Daniel Sampere on and off, like he's taken a couple of issues off here, but for 31 issues
oh my
now.
God,
so what about that? Are you writing for Daniel Sampere at this point? Is it a partnership? Have you become a hive mind? What's the relationship like 31 issues in plus?
Oh, Daniel's the best. He's kind and cool and professional, and he gets stuff done. I work with he meets his deadlines, and he's and draws brilliantly and just beautifully, and presents such a perfect Wonder Woman who is both strong and beautiful and badass, and he just hits the perfect note on it. We're pretty good now. Daniel's good on calling me on my BS, being like, this doesn't work, and I'm like, yes. But by this point, it's almost secondhand nature. He just knows what to do, and I when I write my scripts, I can just see exactly how Daniel could draw and the best things Daniel can draw. And yeah, it's I don't know, it's an utter joy. It's automatic. It reminds me of working with Mikhail Kanin on Batman, just where you're just like, this is so easy. It makes everything easy. And that's
one of the things that I think you, from my outside perspective, write for with Daniel Sampere is he just has these amazing moments of stillness, particularly with Diana, with Wonder Woman, where not necessarily cuts to her, but you'll have like she shows up at the invisible plane or she's standing there while the Sovereign is going crazy or some Mouse Man is going crazy. How do you write towards that? How do you write towards the stillness on a page?
I mean, I think that's kind of how I see her. I mean, I gave her this like catchphrase of no thank you. Like the idea that just like, it's not just their catchphrase, no, it's no thank you. It's that there's a politeness and a quietness to her anger. And she is, you know, she's this kind of rock that the tide breaks against. And he's excellent at putting that in. I mean, her cool superpower is that she can bounce a bullet off her hand. Like that's so cool. I mean, that's just like every little girl in the world wants to do that. And I think that's a still move because what makes it cool is like your body is still, you know, it's that kind of like Bruce Lee thing where if I can just move like one, I'm doing a Bruce Lee chop. Jesus, I'm a fucking nerd.
that's all right. You're in the right place.
Good. I think the idea that her power comes from stillness, that she's not the most kinetic character as like, I don't know, the first guy is Speedball, but that's the most kinetic character. There must be somebody in between Wonder Woman and Speedball. A Gambit.
Love that we squeeze a Speedball ref. Yeah. That's my man.
Gambit's got to move all the time, right? He's got to jump and weave and rube. But Wonder Woman, she's a force of nature. I mean, Batman's always crouching and dodging and moving. But Wonder Woman can just walk into something and walk into a crowd and assert herself. You know, she's a symbol of things. She's not a quiet superhero. Wonder Woman doesn't sneak up on you. Doesn't sneak up on you and jump at you from the ceiling. Wonder Woman crashes down the front door and then throws you against the wall. Like that's Wonder Woman.
With Trinity, you've made a character that can do some great slapstick comedy and also make me cry. Is Wonder War going to be the ultimate combination touch point of those two feelings you've blossomed in me here?
If I do it right, yeah. Because it's in the future, we have, you know, Wonder Woman and Trinity together. You know, we basically have, Old Woman, Wonder Woman, and her daughter fighting together against this sort of matriarch character. And then, you know, this is the time we're going to see if you've read Trinity, the series. It leaves off with sort of Steve Trevor, you know, on his way to return. So I think we're going to see Steve Trevor sort of re-enter this and have for the first time mother, father, daughter. And if I can't make you cry with that reunion, then I'm not doing my job. You know?
Oh, boy.
Pete's so stressed.
Oh, my God.
He's nervous. He's legitimately
nervous. He loves Steve and Diana, so... Yeah. And he loves love.
Don't we all?
Oh, go ahead, Pete.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, first off, I'm so glad when you were sharing that Tim Seeley story that it wasn't like when he said you always be writing four books, you were like, and now I want to kill him because that is an insane amount of work to be cranking out. I am very worried about your stress output because I don't want you to burn out. You write such amazing stories. It's awesome to hear you talk about stories because you do come at it with such an interesting take that it's always fun when I open up one of your books because I'm like, where are we going to go? How is he going to do this? It's really impressive. I love to see the passion. Is that some of the things that makes you light up about doing so much storytelling is like the how does it work? How can I mess with the reader? How like problem solving? Is that kind of what keeps you going and having such an impressive schedule and pace?
I mean, I always remember this, like when I was trying to break in, I remember reading Alan Moore comics, of course, like my whole generation read Alan Moore comics, but like like his DC short stories or even some of his 2000 AD short stories, where he would do with three pages like the most brilliant stuff, like four panels he would blow your mind, you know, or like Mogo Doesn't Live Here, where does that or Mozart, Mogo Doesn't Socialize, that's like I think six or seven pages or something like that. And you just be like, oh my God, this changes how I see comics in six or seven pages. And I remember seeing that and then going and reading comics that were just wastes of space and space and space. I was like, this guy had 20 pages and Alan Moore could have done this in a panel. And just like, why are they like, someone gave this person the privilege of 20 pages of comics and they wasted their time with it. And being just like, there's an anger inside me as both a fan and someone trying to break in, that they didn't put that passion that Moore had put, like the possibility of every single page could be this, and they didn't put it in there. And so I do still feel that when I write a comic, is like, if I'm just writing a comic, I'm just like, man, I got to hit a deadline. I got to make my money. Who cares? Superman punches, you know, I can, Daniel, draw Superman punching, boom, page, two page splash. You know, it would just be, I don't know. I feel like I'd become the thing I hated and God, you don't want to be that, right? You don't want to be that. So yeah, I try always to kind of approach. I mean, obviously, no one can be Alan Moore, but I try to at least approach it to be like, this space is sacred. To me, comic space is a sacred space to be able to create this thing, to be able to make a living out of my favorite job of all time, and I have to fill it. I have to fill every moment with fucking passion, or else what's the point?
How does that specific feeling translate to working in TV and film? Because it's not the same.
A lot of tears and a lot of
yeah, it's just pure pain all the way.
Yeah, it's pure pain. I mean, the good part about that is I have that space in comics. There's a famous quote by what's his name, William, the guy who did the My Adventures in Screenwriting, William.
Goldman,
thank you. I was going to say Gibson. I was like, that's a whole different person. William Goldman, where he says, like, if you want to be creatively fulfilled, if you want to create art in your life, then do something else while you're doing Hollywood. like that's why I write novels and do this. That's why I'm writing this How to Write Script. So, like, I have that. I can do, you know, Animal Pound. I can do Helen of Windhorn. So at least I have that outlet, so that helps in looking at the Hollywood stuff, that I have an outlet for that. And so I kind of put it over there. But in the same, this is, I'm going to regret everything I say now in 2 years when I look back and it's all been terrible. I've done so much in comics. When I finished Human Target and read it over, I really had an existential crisis. Like, this is as good as I can do. It's not my favorite comic I've written, but to me, it's the comic I've always wanted to write since the time I was a little kid. And I've like, what's the next, you know, you want to look for the next hill to climb or else you become that guy. Like I just told you, like who's like just wasting pages to make money. And in Hollywood, there are just a lot of hills that I haven't climbed. So that's the appeal of it now. It feels like such a challenge.
That's cool.
That's what kind of I get that same high I can get from comics. Now that said, it's going to break my heart. All Hollywood does is break your heart. All Hollywood is lies. People just lie to your face all the time. I say that in the nicest, loveliest way. I always say to my kids, you know, I had all these leads and they'd be watching TV and I'd be like, oh my God, this great actor called me and now they want me to do a pilot with them. And they'd be like, oh, it's going to be great, Dad. I was like, yeah, but it'll never happen because everything in Hollywood falls apart. And like, Dad, we're watching TV. Obviously this didn't fall apart. And I was like, I don't know. These are all miracles. Everything you're watching on TV.
It's cozy season and nothing compares to wrapping yourself in a Minky Couture blanket. Luxuriously soft, perfectly warm, thoughtfully made. From movie nights to chilly mornings, Minky Couture turns everyday moments into pure comfort. Once you feel it, you'll understand why it's called the original best blanket ever. Visit MinkyCouture.com or a store near you and make this cozy season your softest one yet.
Well, I do want to ask you about some of these miracles, that just to get into that a little bit, because like you're saying, you've been hitting your head against the wall for a little while here, and now suddenly there are so many things that are definitely coming to fruition, or at least if the world doesn't end, obviously. But
yeah,
the first one out of the gate, this feels kind of crazy, is Supergirl Woman of Tomorrow is being made into the Supergirl movie based directly on the book that you did with Bocas Evely. What is that feeling like as you start to see this stuff roll out, as you see like Millie Alcock at the Puppy Bowl holding puppies and showing off a trailer for Supergirl? That's how I saw the trailer. I'm just mentioning. But what's that feeling like for you?
It makes no sense at all. It's not an easy to describe feeling, because I feel like you've heard creators describe it as, oh my God, what a joy so long that you just expect me to say that. But it's like, it's a joy mixed with a fear mixed with like, I designed this book for a tiny little audience. It wasn't a big hit when it came out. And now like millions, many more millions of people are going to look at this little book, which I adore. But it wasn't made to be under that microscope. You're like, oh my God, is it going to hold up? Like, are they going to find the one flaw in it I never saw? So like, there's an incredible joy mixed with an incredible amount of fear mixed with just surreality. Like, it's all five things at once. It's not one emotion. And I guess then there's, you know, some pride there too. I don't know, whatever. But although if there's a writer who writes without anxiety, I haven't met them yet. I'm not an exception to that rule. So yes, it's happiness and anxiety at the same time.
It's got to be especially crazy because that's coming out sort of first of all the work that you have going. And that's the personal sort of quiet thing you did. And you're like, that one's first. Okay. I'm really exposed here.
And I did not create that. That's something that was created by other people based on my material.
Yeah.
I got to see it along the way. I'm sort of a consultant on all DCU projects. I got to see it made, but I was not the one who was making it. So it's kind of also out of my hands, and I have not seen the movie. I hear from people that it's utterly wonderful. I've seen parts of it, and I can just say that Millie is incredibly wonderful in the parts I've seen. She's just absolutely stunning, and embodies that character perfectly. And I just have, I have faith in James and Craig to pull it off, but I hope it's wonderful. I hope everyone loves it.
Is there a part of you when you hear about what's going on in the movie, you're like, Lobo's not supposed to be in there?
Yeah.
What's he doing there?
There are zero parts of me.
Okay. We mentioned lanterns earlier, and I had a question for my son. He's 11 years old. I told him we were going to be talking to you, and I ran down like your whole comics resume. I asked him, do you have any questions? And the only question he had is, can I watch Lanterns? And to give you a little context there, we took him to see Superman, and then he was like, oh, I'm really into the DCU. Can I watch Peacemaker? And I was like, absolutely not. And he was like, can I watch Creature Commandos? He's like, I don't think so. And so we've been running down all this stuff that he can't watch. So his question is, can he watch Lanterns? Because I told him, I was like, it's an HBO show. It's sort of like True Detective, but with Green Lanterns. I don't think so.
Just haven't watched True Detective season one first.
So yeah, sure. Yeah.
And then,
you know,
yes,
it's the best season. You should see that one anyway.
Problem.
This you have to ask someone who's not me. I don't think
you're stressing him out, Alex.
I'm sorry.
I say TBD. I feel like that's a question that the Lanterns PR people need to tell me what to say. So let me just avoid the question. And be like, I hope everyone watches. I'll let you know as soon as I get my marching orders what the answer to that question is.
Right. Alex, your son's on the phone with Tom King right now. They've been talking for like 45 minutes about if you can watch this.
I will say my I'm watching Preacher Can Ambos with my 17-year-old and it is awkward. So
Good choice.
Another project which we mentioned a little earlier, you are working on Mr. Miracle. This is going to be an animated series, I believe, in the continuity of the DCU, if that's correct. And Mitch Grads, I always get the I'm mispronouncing it definitely, and I'm sorry, is working as a designer on it. The thing that I'm most curious about, and I'm always curious about with these sort of projects, is it going to be based on his art, or is he just using character design? Because I feel like Mitch's look is so intrinsic to the book.
Mitch is both, I should clarify, both a designer and a producer on it. So okay. Mitch is like my partner on it. Every decision I make, I call Mitch. I probably talk to him once a day and I'm be like, oh, in this scene, what did you think of this? Or this scene is, so he's more than just a designer. He's like, he has a voice in all of it. Ooh. Which is wonderful. Cause it's just like having your best friend have your back. And also a guy who's willing to tell me I'm full of shit. His role. The entire series is based on his art. It's gonna be a mix of, I mean, obviously animated. It'll be, his style is almost too detailed to animate. Mm-hmm. It also would take 17 years. So there will be an interpretation of his. I don't think we're allowed to say this. We have hired an incredible Emmy-winning a collaborator who's just one of the geniuses of animation who is working with Mitch. So it's once that comes out, you'll see. So it's kind of a mix of their two designs, but Mitch is incredible. When I told him who it was, he went over the moon. He was just like, oh my God, this is going to be perfect. And they're working hand in hand. It'll be a lot of Mitch and a little bit of this other very famous creator, and it'll be gorgeous.
And have you figured out how to put a 9-panel grid on TV yet?
I'm working on it.
Okay.
Yeah, I know. We're doing it like the Ang Lee Hulk movie. It's going to be,
good.
Very good. I'll just go into grids and you watch all 9, but like the little sign of face here
just
and there.
You'll sliding in.
Just slide in, yeah, for sure.
And then, as you mentioned earlier, you're a consultant on all of the DCU stuff. You were in that initial writer's room with James Gunn when you were hashing out Gods and Monsters. I don't know how much you could talk about this, but like, it seems like that story has changed a lot based on what James has encountered about putting different movies in there, different TV shows being at different development. Is there anything you could say about that? I'm just curious from the outside.
I mean, James and Peter Safran, who are running the studio, are incredibly smart people who are navigating an incredibly difficult landscape of Hollywood. But within that landscape, they've been very consistent in terms of their vision of what the story has been from day one. That means, but not like, oh my God, we're going to overturn every opportunity, you know, incredible opportunities and say no to those because of our vision. And not to the extent we're going to drive our vision down someone's throat and then, you know, throw it all away because of that. They've been flexible in making sure that the best things get made. And that's always been the thing. Like, he's like, here's the plan for what gets made. But if I don't like the scripts, if the scripts suck, it's not getting made. Like, he's not going to be like, the plan goes before the scripts. He's like, here's the
refreshing
plan.
Idea.
Yeah. And so that was his philosophy from day one. And so it's been fairly consistent in his vision. Things like Lanterns was there from day one, and so was Mr. Miracle, the show I'm working on, and so was Supergirl. So all the stuff you're seeing was there on the very first day I talked to James, which is before he even took the job. So he's been consistent with flexibility. Yeah,
I guess that's really awesome to hear. And then you have the example of like the Clayface movie, which I feel like definitely wasn't there when the plan was conceived.
I'm sure there will be books written about what was there and what wasn't there and what disappeared. And I'm ready to testify when I'm 80 years old and and cranky. But yes, no, it's been such a fun ride, and I'm blessed is a loaded word, but I'm I've been very lucky to work with partners like James and Peter, who are just very good at what they do.
I want to move to another media property, which we mentioned earlier, from a different company, the Archie movie that you're doing with Lord and Miller. I'm just curious mostly about the order here, because you did that great Archie the Decision one shot. Yes. Did the Archie the Decision one shot come out of you were already working on the movie, or did the movie come out of the one shot, or was it just a coincidence?
Both of them came from the same place, which is that my children, I have three children, during COVID became obsessed with Archie.
Fun.
I think I just got them a subscription. They were younger, obviously. They were younger then. Turns out time moves forward, guys. Breaking news on this podcast.
I hate that.
Man, that doesn't work for me at all.
Yes, but all three of them were like Archie obsessed. My 17-year-old, obviously, he was 12 then, so it's different. But and so my house filled with Archie comics, like, and that was the one thing they could all three of them do together. And they just read, and I did not grow up on, I mean, obviously everyone's aware of Archie and Betty and Veronica, but it wasn't, as a guy who grew up in comics, I was much more Marvel DC than Archie. And so with my kids being obsessed with this sort of Archie phenomenon, I had like, what is this? You know, it's like, I better read it to see how much I was rotting their brains. And I read it and I found just, you know, there was a charm in it, and there was, I could start to see what my children, that's a wonderful thing when you can, your children bring you to something as opposed to you bringing something to your children. You can see the charm in something that maybe you dismissed as corny or silly or, same thing happened. My son's super like WWE fan. I always found it to be like a corny thing. And he kind of took me into the media. I was like, oh man, I really like it. Mm-hmm. And so in that, and when I, you know, I do a job that should impress my kids. Like, I'm, you know, hey, the superheroes in a movie based, and they're just never impressed. So I literally reached out to Archie Comics. I was like, can I do a comic with you? I was at the Eisner Awards, and I saw Mike Proletta, who's the head of Archie Comics, the president. And I said, hey, I just cornered him, like after the show, just because when are we all together then? I was like, hey, I never see you. Can I? My name's Tom King. I think I had won some. I was like, I just won these awards. Can I write an Archie for you? And he's like, yeah, you can write an Archie for me. And DC's like, you're under contract. I was like, shh. Wait. And so that's and in a very similar vein, I was. I'm sure I'll tell the whole situation, but I was in a situation where someone was looking for a movie property, and I was like, well, do you know what I love? I love Archie. And they're like, you love Archie? And I was like, yes. And I just happened to know every single thing about Archie because my kids knew, because we talked about it. Cons, like, I can tell you who drew it, who all the characters are, because it was a topic of conversation with my children. So I was like, I know Archie. And they're like, oh my God. So then through that sort of passion, someone looking for a project, I developed this Archie movie, which we have at Universal with Lord Miller.
I don't know. I understand it's very early days. I don't know how much you can say about the tone of it, but obviously we've had like very dark Archie stuff like Riverdale, which we love. We did a whole podcast about Riverdale.
We've talked a lot about
Riverdale is an experience. Obviously, before I wrote this movie, I was going to watch a lot of Riverdale, and whew, that is an experience. That is
it's high adrenaline TV right there.
It is. It's high adrenaline TV. It's a TV that was not afraid to go anywhere and everywhere.
Yes.
Like nothing was off the board. In
sometimes minute by minute. Yeah. They crammed a lot in there.
So you have that, and then you have like the more earnest takes. Like, I don't know if you saw the Bollywood movie that just came out.
I did see the Bollywood movie. Yes. Very
rap and Jughead TV movie from back in the day, which is also, I don't know. It is what it is. Are you able to say like, where does it sit in that spectrum of Archie stuff?
I mean, everything I do has a little bit of deconstruction in it. Everything I do has a little bit of. I don't know if what I do is called deconstruction as much as reconstruction. It goes back to like the origins of it and tries to modernize it. Tries to find the deeper theme. Mm-hmm. It'll be definitely safer for your kids to see than Creature Commandos. I'll say that.
The Maginot line of Creature Commandos.
Yes, the Maginot line of Creature. It's on that. I probably shouldn't talk about what exactly it is, but it's meant to be a huge, you know, it's meant to be like Barbie. It's meant to be a huge movie that lots of people can see that has a deep theme at its center that talks about sort of where we are as a culture and where we are as humans. Yeah.
Exciting.
That's cool.
moving back to comics a little bit, but still sort of straddling the line, because I know, I believe there's a movie in development, but Love Everlasting, we love that series here. That is very deconstructive. When's it coming back, Tom?
Yeah.
That's a question for my brilliant partner, Elsa Chartier. I have a disease, guys. It is a terrible virus that lives within my writing that writers who work with me, after they work with me, are like, well, that obviously Tom has the easiest job in the world and I want his job. So they go off and write for themselves. And this has happened to me lately almost every time I work with an artist. Doc Shaner is writing for himself. Mitch Gerrards is writing for himself. Clay Mann is writing for himself. Greg Smallwood is writing for herself. Joelle Jones is writing for herself.
Is that a compliment or an insult?
Are it's they like, definitely an insult, guys.
If he can do it, I'm doing it. Definitely.
David Marquez was right, left me to go write for himself. I'm just waiting to hear Brian Sook just did it. I don't. It's constant. It's constant. And it. Look, like if a writer goes off to go write for Tim Seeley, you can kind of badmouth Tim Seeley. Oh, Tim Seeley, you know, he's a little too into Chicago. You know, I don't know what you can say. Like, it's like bad about Tim Seeley. But like, you can try to like get the. But how do you bash writers if they're writing for, you know, themselves? You know, like, oh, Doc, you're working for Doc Shaner again? That guy, I don't know. What's underneath that baseball cap? You never know, right? Elsa, after we were working for a while, decided to do, she got a wonderful deal to do her own writing, which was brilliant. And so she took a break to do that. When she's done with that break, I will happily and joyously continue the story. We're halfway through. The good news is we sold it as a movie to Sony as part of the deal to sell it. Of course, they're like, hey, does this end?
yeah.
And so I had to write the second half, or at least do a very detailed outline of exactly how it ends and break it down almost issue by issue, beat by beat. So it's all written. Wow. I have to put it into comic form, but it's done. Like, I know the ending. I know exactly how it happens. I know exactly how each of the 15 issues breaks down. So we just have to find a time for Elsa to draw it. And as soon as she agrees to do that, we'll draw it. But I appreciate you guys writing. It's weird. So like, I've written so many things. I think the best thing I ever wrote, just in terms of quality, was the second volume of Love Everlasting, which is so randomly bizarre. But just in terms of like a thing that was hard to pull off, and I think I pulled off in a good way, I'm so proud of that bizarrely second volume of an uncompleted series that's now a movie.
What about, I believe this just came out in stores. There's a deluxe edition of Helland of Windhorn, which we also loved. And that's very nicely timed for you and Bilquis also having Supergirl, Woman of Tomorrow with the movie, etc. But what is that developing relationship like with Bilquis? Like, what was different with Helland of Windhorn versus Supergirl?
It was like six more lines per page, which was not possible. When I was on Supergirl, I was like, this is just going. And again, it wasn't a big seller. It wasn't a big hit. But I was like, I just love what she was doing. She was transforming this little script into high art, like doing things. I work with the best artists in comics. And I had just come off working with Greg Smallwood, who I consider to be the best artist in comics, except for Mitch, who's obviously my best buddy. Bilquis was blowing me absolutely out of the water. And I was like, I wrote her a note when we were done. I was like, I will, whatever you want to do next, I will do it. If you want to do Supergirl Part 2, if you want to do Batman, if you want to go over and do Fantastic Four, I'll leave DC and we'll just have or if you want to do an indie thing, we'll do an indie thing. And she said she wanted to do an indie thing. And that's how we ended up doing Helen Winter. But the main difference was, she'll obviously copy this, and I think you can see on the page, Supergirl is I couldn't talk higher about the art in Supergirl. It's absolutely brilliant. And she did that, you know, she was doing eight issues. It probably took her a year and a half or so, maybe 14 months or something. For Helen, that's six issues. That took her 3.5 years. I wrote Helen right after Supergirl. It was literally written like the day I put down the Supergirl thing. I wrote Helen, so she would have the next start. Thing, the next start. And it came out quite a few years later. And it's not a kind of book. I've been with artists who take that long to write a book, and you can't see it. It's like, oh my goodness, they're, you know, obviously they're just going through something. It took them a while to get there. Like, she was at that board every day in those 3.5 years, putting more and more lines and more art and more passion into this book. And you see it on every page of Helen. I wrote her a note, and don't tell Mitch this, after issue 5, where I was like, this is the best looking book I've ever, I worked on hundreds and hundreds of books, is the best looking book I've ever worked on. And I was like, maybe the best looking book I've ever seen for all I know. And I was just like, mm-hmm. I cannot believe that. So the difference of as beautiful as Supergirl is, it's Helen is on another level of just beauty and creation that Bill Kiss sent it.
It feels like for Supergirl, she's sort of wrapped her arms around that story. And with Helen, it's like the story was like wrapping its arms around her and be like, yes. Get over here.
Yeah, just like everywhere. And people ask me, because that sort of kind of end, it kind of peters out. I mean, I don't mean in a bad way, but it's the end of, it feels like the end of a first chapter. And people are like, what happened to this thread and this thread and this thread? I was like, yeah, it was supposed to be more chapters, but I can't just be like, hey, can I have 3.5 more years of your life? Like she has to take a breath and live a little life before she goes back into that. So that's why Helen is like the first chapter of something that we haven't started the second chapter of.
Is there a second chapter, or is there a third part of this loose trilogy that you guys are creating, or does she actually just need a break and you'll come back to it later?
There's definitely a second chapter of Helen. As soon as we have it plotted out, we know what it is. DC obviously wants us to do another Supergirl. I don't think we ever will. And I say that as someone who's going to come on your podcast 2 years from now and be like, oh man, I really needed that house in California. So we're doing, I realize at some point I will sell out and do that. But as of now, I don't want to touch Supergirl, because I just think it's a perfect little gem of a book.
And can I throw out there, maybe to convince you, Supergirl, Woman of Tomorrow?
No,
I'm just really saying. I don't know.
Tom King agreed immediately to do it.
You're making it worse. You're pushing back the deadline.
That's the moment he sold out.
And Alex itself. It writes itself. Oh my God, it writes itself.
You have some amazing, you talked about your house being eaten alive by comics. You have some amazing stuff behind you there. Is there anything you want to point to or show off?
My Supergirl statue. I have my Mr. Miracle trying to inspire me. I have old action comics, Lois. I'm working on a Lois and Superman project now, so I can stare at that. And I have my three kids when they were little
and it's a wall of inspiration.
There's lots of, I mean, if you look behind, there's a bunch of comic book art behind me, and then if you could look on the other side of the computer, it's all comic book art and old sort of illustration art, which is covered. My office is covered with comics and art, just anywhere I can look to try to find, again, like I said, those 47 stories I have to write. Just anything to get me to not leave my desk and keep writing is here. But yeah, that's it. Yeah, I mean, there's a picture from old noir. I love old noirs. That's from Laura, signed by the stars. And my fam, my wife, my kids, that kind of book. Kite Man's up there. I'm terrible. I'm not toyetic. There are people like Jeff Johns or James Tynan or Scott Snyder, they just do things and people make toys of them. I don't do that. People don't make toys of my crap. I'm sad, but they did make a Kite Man toy, and they did make a Lee Weeks Batman statue for my run. So that's cool.
Is there anything you can say about the Superman and Lois project? I hadn't heard about that.
Oh, it's brand new. It's very fun. I love it. We have maybe an artist. We're determining it. But yeah, it's utterly, it's brand new. No one's ever talked about it before. It's my first time I've ever said it. But yeah, it's I got a challenge from our editor, for our brilliant editor chief, Marie Javins, who's running DC Comics on a high that it's never been on before. We just had this summit, and it was just amazing to be like, I mean, I've been with the company. I'm now the longest tenured writer who didn't leave. Some people left and came back, but I've been there the longest without leaving. And this is the best we've ever been, just in terms of our sales numbers and in terms of just how happy people are. And in terms
you
of
feel the, it output. In the streets, the people we're talking to on our show, man, the high is everywhere. I'm glad you guys are feeling it.
And it comes right from Jim Lee and Marie Javins, the heads of the company, who are just brilliant, brilliant leaders of this thing. But Marie came to me and she's like, this is a genre that comics can't do, and we don't know how to do it, and it's impossible. And like I said, I'm always looking for that freaking mountain. I said, give it to me, I can do it.
Yeah.
So that's where when I talk more about it, that's where the Lois Superman project comes from.
Yeah. Do you have any talking about the high of DC Comics, do you have any hankering to do an Absolute Universe title?
No, I don't. No, I don't. That's kind of, I don't know. I have a hankering to do more of what I did before I came to Wonder Woman, which is to do these short projects, to do these Human Targets, Black Canary. I like these little short Vision, obviously. That I have a hankering to do that, to write these little comics that are novels. I think Absolute is a whole universe that involves a ton of and it's Scott's baby, and I want him to run as far with it he can. All the attention should be on where that's going. But yeah, it doesn't hit me for some reason. I don't know. Like, it's hard to. I'm so everyone I talk to reads those books. I think they're brilliant. I love the Wonder Woman book. It's been just an absolute joy to have that book on the shelves. And Jason Aaron's Superman is fantastic, and the Martian Manhunter book is fucking blowing minds. And there's just very good books. I was just talking about the new Green Arrow book, and I think I got a pitch to me. I was like, oh my god, that's amazing. So yeah, there's absolute brilliant stuff coming. But that's not kind of what I do. I do a thing where I take, I don't know, I like these characters. I like the continuity that's in them, as opposed to remaking them for a new continuity. And right. it's kind of subtle, the difference, but it makes sense in my head.
You're painting a landscape at the seashore with those characters, I feel like.
Yeah, I don't remake. I mean, I loved Ultimate Universe when it came in. I mean, I dug the crap out of that. But I have no desire to redo superheroes. I want to just take what's there and make it awesome. I know it's somehow different in my head.
Yeah. And just to wrap it back to Wonder Woman, given everything we've been talking about and all the demands on your time, are you still on it for the long haul? Does Wonder War finish up your run? Where are you at with that?
It's in the air. I have to say, I am overwhelmed with projects now, and something's got to give. So I used to be able to promise that I'm going to be on lots of things forever, but right now I can just promise that Mr. Miracle is going to be a fantastic show.
All right.
We'll take it.
Great. Tom, thank you so much for everything. Yes. Really looking forward to Wonder War. Looking forward to your big media year as well. And good luck with that. And thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Yeah. Thanks for all the great work.
Thank you for it. Can I endorse or what is it called? Pitch one thing or
yeah,
or,
please.
Okay. Please.
We talked, I know this is obviously implied, but Supergirl Woman of Tomorrow is this little gem of a book that the movie's coming out. And if you haven't read that book, or if you have read it, it's the first book I've written that you can give to a new comic book reader. I love Mr. Miracle. That's hard. That's a hard sell for someone who's never read a comic book before.
Yeah.
Same with Human Target, another book I mentioned. But Supergirl, it's a magic gift I see over and over again, that if you love our medium and want to bring people into this, that book is going to be in every bookstore. It's going to be everywhere. Tell a friend, tell someone who's never read a comic, there's a movie coming. You can buy it in a $10 version. You can buy it in a $50 version. You can find the version that fits sort of your pocketbook, and have them read it and invite them into our hobby. It's a wonder that way.
It's been kind of amazing, actually. I mean, I know sales charts are kind of limited, but whenever there's like a Supergirl shows up at the end of Superman, you just see that bump in sales of the graphic novel, or the trailer comes out, there's a bump. And like you mentioned, there's the compact comic for people who don't know or listening. Like you said, it's $9.99. It's a small size. You can put it in your pocket, and it's an awesome treat.
Good double digest.
I've never had a book like this before, guys. It's crazy. Like, because people, when I do cons, and people buy it like a pack of M&Ms. Just every single person who comes up buys it, and it's a book that everyone likes. Like, you give it like a 10-year-old can read it, a 90-year-old can read it, and you know, like Marv Wolfman told me he freaking loves it, and my son's a 12-year-old, and it's like, you know, his friend at school loves it. Like, it goes the utter gauntlet. I just got super lucky that a book that with universal appeal is getting this much of a spotlight on it. So I'm super happy with that.
Awesome. Tom, awesome. Thank you again. Congrats so much on everything.
Yeah. My absolute pleasure.
Yeah!
It's cozy season, and nothing compares to wrapping yourself in a Minky Couture blanket. Luxuriously soft, perfectly warm, thoughtfully made. From movie nights to chilly mornings, Minky Couture turns everyday moments into pure comfort. Once you feel it, you'll understand why it's called the original best blanket ever. Visit minkycouture.com or a store near you and make this cozy season your softest one yet.